arbitrarily stops at verse 11 and really ought to continue through verse 15. So if you're planning to preach on this, it wouldn't hurt my feelings at all if you preached on 2 to 6, you know, or preached on 7 to 15 or some part of that. But I think it might be hard to find some sort of a unified approach to a sort of bifurcated text. But at any rate, it is eschatology, so my kind of stuff here. Verse 2, the John heard, or maybe because he heard here, works quite well. Because he heard ento desmoterio, he's in prison, right? He's in chapter 4, a brief mention was made that John had been arrested, and that's why Jesus withdraws and goes to dwell in Capernaum. And then in chapter 14, you actually get the story of Jesus, John's reason why he was arrested and his eventual beheading. But in terms of the timeline here, John's in prison. And because he heard in prison, ta erga tu Christu, note that the evangelist, the narrator, leaves no doubt as to the answer to the question, because he calls Jesus, he speaks of the works of Christ. Okay, so just in case the reader himself is kind of wishy-washy, we make it very clear who Jesus is. He is the Christ. Pemsas, we'll take that as just sort of attendant circumstances. He sent through his disciples, and he said to him. Now, apparently in the early church, there was a lot of concern trying to protect the Baptists' theological reputation here. That a lot of the early fathers couldn't fathom the idea that John the Baptizer would actually have a question about the true identity of Jesus. And so proposals are made such as John really sent this question, but he was sure, but it was just for the sake of his disciples to encourage them. Or John is sort of functioning as Jesus' straight man here and giving Jesus an opportunity to teach the crowds. And although I suppose you could, you know, come to either one of those conclusions, I really rather think that John, whose message, as you recall from chapter 3, has been one of eschatological judgment. John has spoken of the parousia, right? And he has correctly, John's not wrong, okay? He has correctly identified Jesus as the coming one whose winnowing fork is in his hand, and he will separate the wheat from the chaff. John is absolutely right. But the problem is that Jesus' ministry doesn't look like that at all, right? And to echo a phrase that I got from Jack Kingsbury, and I think it's quite right and adequate, John's understanding of Jesus is correct but insufficient. And what he doesn't understand is that the way that Jesus' eschatological ministry as the coming Christ will manifest itself in the present time is as a ministry of compassion and salvation. And the judgment day is yet to come. The consummation of the age is yet to come. John has the timing wrong, in a sense. And he's in jail. Things are not looking too good for the precursor of the Messiah, you know? So I think we can understand John's question as a real question. You know, are you the coming one? Right? And that's supported by the verb in verse 3. He said, John asks the question to him, and then, si e ha erchamenas, are you the coming one? Or, now a deliberative subjunctive, pros decomen, shall we look or expect another? Question. So again, John isn't wrong. He's just confused or has an insufficient understanding of the way the reign of heaven and the king of it, namely Jesus, is presently at work. Okay, and the disciples themselves show the same kind of confusion on a number of occasions. Are you the coming one, or shall we expect another? And, verse 4, answering, here's the typical sort of pleonastic or unnecessary participle, answering, the Jesus said to them, going, announce, or you could maybe turn it into an attendant imperative, go, announce, ap angelita, to John, ha akuta, that which you are hearing and seeing. And now we have the allusions to Isaiah 35, right, and also to Isaiah 29, but Isaiah 35, which was just, you know, we just worked through, is taken as the general source for these allusions. Blind guys receive sight, they look up, and lame guys walk. Yeah, I'm starting to sound like Bartelt now. And leprous guys are being cleansed, katharizontai, present indicative passive, and blunt people are hearing. If I'm remembering right, I didn't look this up, I think kafus actually means blunt, and it can mean blunt of speech or blunt of ear. You know, in this case, because they're hearing, it clearly means blunt of ear. So a deaf hear, and dead people, ageronti, are being raised, and poor are being good newsed, right? Are having good news preached to them. And now comes, in a sense, the punchline and end of this statement, and blessed, makarios, is hasean, whoever is not scandalized. The aorist subjunctive passive of scandalizo, my. Whoever is not scandalized, en emoi, take it as causal dative, because of me. Okay. This is what you're going to get. What you see is what you get. See? If you can recognize in my present ministry the manifestation of the reign of heaven, God's saving power, the coming one, this is who I am. Blessed are you if you are not John and anybody else caused to stumble because of me, because this is the me that I'm going to be, right? This is the way it's going to work itself out, right? In lowly service, which will ultimately issue forth in crucifixion. Dave? Well, we don't know. I mean, historically, there was some overlap, right, between John's continued ministry at the Jordan and Jesus' ministry. We know that from the fourth gospel. Yeah. I just think prison has gotten to him, right? I mean, he keeps waiting for the end to come, for the judgment to issue forth, and it simply isn't happening.
He's probably wondering why Jesus doesn't quote Isaiah 61 and says, released to the prisoners.
Sure, sure. Or why Jesus doesn't fulfill Isaiah 66.
There's one of those, yeah.
Yeah, where he throws them into the fire, right, where their worm is not quenched and their fire is not abated, you know.
The axe is laid to the root, but it hasn't moved.
I know. John wants the axe to pull back and wham. Right, well, fair enough. And the point is, Jesus is going to do that. Right? But not yet. See? That's right. Yeah, his way. That's right. And this word blessed, by the way, is very strong. I mean, it's terrible to translate it happy because of what happy means in English. Look it up. It occurs half a dozen times in Matthew besides the Beatitudes. And I would argue that it's equivalent to saved. I mean, it's a salvation word. This is not, like the Jesus Seminar's translation of the Beatitudes, congratulations to the poor in spirit. No, this is a little stronger than that. So the one who doesn't stumble over me, the one who, again, by the miracle of conversion and the Heavenly Father revealing Jesus' identity, Matthew 16, etc., etc., the one who does not stumble over this Jesus, but who accepts this Jesus and this kind of ministry as God's work, is blessed. Right? I mean, that's the point. Now, did John get it? Well, we don't know. Okay. I'd like to think he did. We have no reason, in a sense, where's the burden of proof? No reason to think that he wasn't reassured and, kind of sort of hung in there till the end of his own bodily existence, at least. But that's sort of outside our concern here. Hold on a second. I hated to do that in the microphone. Well, now the scene shifts, and Jesus takes the opportunity, by the way, verses 7 to 15 is just packed with theology and with, salvation history and eschatology and the paradox of this inbreaking kingdom. So Jesus takes the opportunity to teach about John and John's significance, and indirectly, therefore, to teach about himself. Okay, and there's some great stuff in here, and you can't possibly get to it all, but we'll just kind of rip through this. We have a genitive absolute, verse 7, tutone poreuomenon. As these were going away, Jesus began to say to the crowds about John. Now we have a little debate here. You can tell the punctuation, te ex eiltha te eistun erimun. Do we stop there, or do we stop at theazastha? You can see the variation there. And it sort of depends on how you translate te, that interrogative particle. If you translate it as what, then you run on to the second infinitive. What did you go out in the wilderness to see? But if you translate it as it can be translated, why, then you'd stop and you'd say, why did you go out into the wilderness, and ask the question, to see? So it really doesn't matter theologically. It just all sort of hinges on how you take te. And I think I, just because it more commonly means what, I think I'll take it that way. So what did you go out into the desert, theazasthai, to see? Question. Now, a kalamon, it's accusative, so you understand, to see a kalamon, hippa anemu saleu menon, a reed being shaken by wind. And I think it's valid. Most people see this as sort of a metaphor for a vacillating kind of person, right? And the expected answer would be, nobody could think that John was that kind of guy, right? So the answer is no. Okay, if that's not what you went out to see, then Allah, rather, verse 8, what did you go out to see? Now, another accusative expecting, I don't think there's any significance between the variation on theaomai and hora'o here, just maybe a stylistic difference. But what did you go out to see, Idain? Did you go out to see an anthropon en malakois, I can't pronounce, emphias menon, a guy in soft things having been dressed or wrapped around? Okay. Did you go out to see a guy in soft clothing? Idu, look. Hoi ta malaka foruntes, those who literally are carrying or wearing the soft things, en tois oikois ton basileon azin, are in the houses of kings. A little joking going on here, because John isn't in the king's house. He's in the king's prison. Okay. So clearly, you didn't go out to see that, right? So we've got no. Rather, verse 9, te ex eltha te edain. What did you go out to see? A prophet. Nigh, absolutely. But the important thing is that Jesus doesn't stop with nigh. He says, yes, and I say to you, also a greater thing of a prophet. A genitive of comparison, pretty standard. This one, houtos, is concerning whom it stands written, and now he quotes Malachi 3:1. Idu ego apostello, behold, I am sending my angel, my messenger, before your face. Change of pronoun is significant. Malachi says, my face, right? So Jesus stands in the place of Yahweh, that standard New Testament move. Hus kadeskeuaze, who will prepare the way of you before you? So John isn't just a prophet, he fulfills prophecy, right? So he is a prophet, and he is more than a prophet, because he is the one who inaugurates the eschatological reality prophesied in Malachi 3, and by implication in just a couple of verses, Malachi 4, in which the coming of Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord is prophesied. Jesus is saying here, and what a paradox. I mean, you see what's happening? Blind guys, deaf people, you know, dead and poor. Poor are having good news preached to them, and John's in prison, and I'm going to be crucified, and this is the great and terrible day of the Lord. I mean, what a different way of thinking about the power of God, about the reign of heaven. But it gives real punch, doesn't it, to blessed is the one who is not scandalized because of me. Because this is the power you're going to see. This is the reign that's going to be manifested, at least now. Right? Do you see? I mean, get this. It is magnificent theology of the cross. It's everywhere. See, the same theology in the Bible. Okay? It's just that Matthew does it a little differently than John, who does it a little differently than Paul. But it's the same theology. Wonderful stuff. Let's see, verse 11. Oh, and that's where the text actually ends. For some bizarre reason. Amen, Lego, you mean. I say to you, let's see, engene tois, among the things born of women, there has not been raised, there does not stand raised, a greater of John the Baptist, anyone greater than John the Baptist. Okay, well, that makes sense, because we've just said he fulfills Malachi 3:1. That's cool. But now Jesus shocks them again. But the least, mikrateros is actually a comparative form, but the comparatives and the superlatives mush together in the New Testament, and it's normally translated least rather than lesser. But the least one in the reign of heaven Mezon autu estin, is greater of him, is greater than him. Now, I think those commentators are right who say this is not meant as a criticism of John the Baptist. It is meant as a magnification of the reign of heaven, right? So no human being in the world ever born is greater than John. But so crucial are the times, right? And Jesus, this is why it makes no sense to stop here, because he goes on to talk about the times and the character of the times. And then the punchline is, if you are able to receive it, he's Elijah who is to come. I mean, how can you preach this part of this paragraph without preaching the rest of it? Well, so if you want to, just pull the other four verses in and do it. Sin boldly, right? But as great as John is, the one who is least, some people take this as a reference to Jesus himself. It seems very unlikely to me, as you know, that Jesus is himself the least one in the reign of heavens. He never talks about himself that way that I can think of. I think it's simply a way of saying, as great as John is, his role is preparatory, and now the turning of the ages has come, right? And even the least one who stands by discipleship, in a disciple relationship to Jesus, who stands in the reign of heaven, is greater than John. I mean, it's a way of saying, look what's come, right? The reign of heaven. And that's actually where the text stops. There's some very interesting and difficult things in verse 12. But just to catch that sense of the turning of the ages, look at what happens just quickly. From the days of John the Baptist until now, the reign of heaven is being forcefully attacked and violent people try to grab it. So on the one hand, John, you know, he's the hinge. From the one hand, the reign of heaven is from the days of John until now. But in the very next verse, for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John. So in verse 12, John is the hinge of the beginning of the manifestation of the reign. But in verse 13, he's the closing of the age of the prophesying of the law and the prophets. See? So John is, you know, he's astride the ages, right? Which is why he's greater than anyone born of woman. Okay, but precisely because he's transitional, he points to this guy who's talking and the salvation that he himself has come to bring. But again, in a paradoxical way, because what kind of a kingdom is it that can be attacked by violent men and be, you know, be violated? I mean, it's the theology of the cross, sort of in seminal form, which will issue forth fully at Jesus' own death. Ask that same question in a different way.
The lecture, we heard this before.
Sure.
We didn't really get the theology of the cross in there.
Right.
Was it underneath the things there? I mean, was it talk about that?
Right.
Or are we actually missing something?
Well, I would say that what Tom Long said, regardless of whether or not... Okay, I had no problem accepting the things that he said, and in terms of fitting it into, a cross-centered eschatology. That is the manifestation of the present, the future present God, right? Now, what he would say, I'm not sure. I would rather suspect that he, too, would connect it to the cross, just from things he said yesterday to the faculty, right? But he was sort of singing one stanza, and he didn't get into, you know, the other things. But I'm sitting... Poor Mark Serberg happened to be standing next to me. And after a while, Long would say something, and I'd go, yep. And every time I do that, Mark would go like this. After a while, I said, I'm just agreeing with him, just ignore me. Because so many of the things, I mean, that he said, I thought were just terrifically important. Yeah. And he doesn't always talk in our categories, but that's okay. Yeah, because we have our categories and we can take so much of what he said and just say, it's so biblical and so Christian. Right. Right. Yeah.
This comment about Matthew being more futuristic as opposed to John more present.
Right.
I think this text here is saying that, you know, Matthew is more present here because the thing about John that makes him different than the prophets is that
okay. Okay. Right. Yeah. Well, now his comment was, if I'm hearing you right, his comment was about the evangelist St. John, not about John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Oh, very much. Absolutely. In terms of the balance of material, it is absolutely correct to say that the Gospel of Matthew has more future eschatology material than any of the other Gospels. That's absolutely true. I mean, you have sheep and the goats, you have all those parables in end of 24 and 25. So that part is true. But you're also absolutely right that Matthew has a very strong theme of the presence, to use George Ladd's. And by the way, that's a wonderful book. I mean, if you're looking for a theological study of New Testament synoptic Gospels eschatology, read George Ladd, The Presence of the Future. See, Long didn't make that phrase up. He simply adapted it. You know, he talked about the future present. And 30 years ago, George Ladd wrote this book, which is a terrific study in many ways. And you're absolutely right. Matthew has a very strong proclamation that the reign of heaven, it stands near. So near as to begin, right? See, don't get me started. Mr. Eschatology. Great. I love this stuff. I just love it. Yeah.
One question before.
Yes.
Three times he says, what did you go out?
Yeah.
The first time he says, mm-hmm. Yes, he's back.
Right, right. To be.